Northwestern Medicine, relentless in their pursuit of better health care. Learn more at nm.org/better.
Time for our Monday morning visit with the Chief Medical Officer at Northwestern Medicine Central DuPage Hospital, Dr. Kevin Most. Doc, good morning. Let's talk first about football coming off a weekend of high school, college, and pro activity. There is a new study involving concussions, and what do you make of this?
Yeah, Bob, it's, you know, it's interesting. We've been trying to figure out how to decrease the chance of concussions, and unfortunately that just hasn't worked, right? We can't build equipment better. We can build equipment that identifies concussions, but we really can't make it much safer. And you couple that with players getting faster, players getting stronger, and we know that concussions are going to be there. So one of the things that we do look at then is, okay, well, when can we put somebody back after a concussion? And historically, we've gone based on their symptoms and any activity that they may have with symptoms. But University of California in San Francisco now has designed, it's kind of a headset skull cap kind of thing, that what it does is it actually measures the pressure with each heartbeat that it interacts in your brain. So what they found is that those pressures stay up for 12 days up to after 12 days post all your symptoms being gone. So in other words, it looks like we are putting patients or players back in the game sooner than we should be, which is why we're seeing, you know, increase in CTE. We're seeing an increase in many other brain disorders in football players after a long period of time.
So do you foresee a time that football officials, coaches, trainers, and so forth will use some different equipment, some new things to measure what's going on after a player has been hit in the head?
Well, absolutely. I think what we're going to look for is going to look for more objective data instead of subjective data. You know, someone telling us how they're feeling and telling us what their symptoms are versus us being able to actually measure that. Unfortunately, players often want to get back in the game. You know, that's their goal. College players want to get back in the game. The next step is to make the pros, and they may push themselves to go back sooner. So what we need is really objective data that say when you hit this number on whatever screening we're going to use, then we know that the potential of you injuring your brain has decreased. So eventually we have to get to a point where we're protecting these young student athletes' brains and actually professionals as well to make sure that we're not going to have more individuals with Parkinson's or Alzheimer's or CTE. So really need to do something because we've already figured out that the speed of these players, we cannot build equipment safe enough to protect concussions.
Players are getting faster and bigger. We talk a lot about various addictions here, and lately you've been hearing a lot about people addicted to the internet, and there's a study that was done on this. What did it tell us?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. How many times have you heard a parent say to the child or say to somebody, you're addicted to the internet? And just like you said, we really haven't had anybody look at it. We just kind of flippantly say it because people spend a lot of time online. And what they did at the University of Surrey is they looked at a time study of this, and they broke these down into different classifications to show that there actually is an addiction to the internet. And, you know, it's broken down everything from casual users, other people, in other words, people that go on for a specific reason, get on, get their reasoning, get their information, and get off. And then moving up a little bit, she's going to go to people who, you know, they went there to get something, but they stayed a little bit longer than they would have, but really won't neglect anything in their lives, their personal lives, or their work. And then once you hit that tipping point, you know, you have a group that says, hey, I'm really uncomfortable if I'm not around where I can have access to the internet. I need to have access to the internet, or they feel uncomfortable. And then you get into the ones who are addicted, you know, the ones that really will spend more time on the internet, even though they know it has a negative impact on their life, on their job, on their family situation. So really, it's very interesting as they broke these down, and everyone can probably sit there and figure out, where do you fit in one of these five categories, and is it a problem? So I think you'll see more and more on it, and then also, what are we going to do about it, especially with young kids who are using computers and internet as often as they are now. Rare to see someone reading a book these days, but often seeing kids on the internet doing something.
I was looking at the numbers of these groups broken down in the study, and as with other addictions, you have a lot of people who are in the category addicts in denial, don't you?
Yeah, you really do. You know, these are individuals that show behaviors that appear to make them appear to look addicted. You know, they're neglecting things in the real world, but they won't admit that they don't feel, you know, that they feel like they're spending too much time, or they won't admit. Just like any time you have an addiction with somebody in denial says, you know, oh, I don't, I could stop drinking at any time, or, oh, I don't abuse this. You know, these are those same individuals where they won't look to see that it's impacting their life and impacting them in a negative action, but it is there. And when somebody steps back and looks and says, hey, you know what? You really are. So those addicts in denial, when you compare those with those who are addicts and say, hey, you know what? I know this is, we're talking about 40% of the population, which is quite scary when we look at the youths of going on, what's going on with young kids and video gaming and how much time they're spending online. Where are we headed with this?
Yeah, seems to be getting worse, too. Let's talk a little bit about weight loss. You hear a lot about intermittent fasting these days. Does it work? Is it healthy?
Yeah, great that you asked the question that way. Does it work and is it healthy?
Yeah, right.
We do know that it works. And intermittent fasting, we have to understand that there's many different types. The type that is probably the most popular now is the timing of it. Individuals who say, I'm not going to eat anything after 7 o'clock at night, and I'm not going to eat again until, you know, 10 or 11 the next day. So you have a block of time, but you're still eating each of the time, each day. And what it does is the body says, hey, you know what, I need so much energy to just keep myself going. And when I don't have that energy that comes in at a regular basis, then I have to go and look to see where I have stored energy, whether it's in my liver, where we have stuff called glycogen, or whether it's in fat. So we're burning those stored groups of energy instead of energy that we have taken in. So for people, if they do it right and they don't overeat during that time, it certainly will work. You will certainly lose weight based on your caloric intake, and the body has to burn something for its energy.
There are different methods of intermittent fasting. Is one better than another?
Well, I think the one, if you're going to do one that you're going to say is more sustainable, I would do the timing. I don't think individuals, you know, there's called something called a 5-2 fast where you eat normal diet for 5 days and then you fast for 2 days. So, and it's not in that order. You don't do it. You do like 2 days fast, 3 days fast. So, but out of the week, you're going to eat for 5 days and fast for 2 days. That's pretty difficult for people because when people do fast, they end up finding that they're a little more irritable, they don't have energy, they're fatigued. But then others will do, you know, alternating, you know, eat about 500 calories one day and then eat their normal diet the next day. So it's not a complete fast, but certainly it's a way cut back on the amount of calories that you take in. But the most sustainable for individuals is probably the evening 7 p.m. to 11 a.m. Fasting time.
I always heard that it was bad to fast because then your body wants to just grab any fat it can get once you do eat, and then you'll gain weight. But I guess that's not the thinking now, is it?
Well, the body is certainly going to, whatever you, when you do eat, the body is still going to say, hey, I've depleted some of my sources, so I'm going to take some of those in and try to save those as much as you can. So that's one of the things that we tell people. If you're going to do the intermittent fasting and you're going to do this, don't eat 5,000 calories during those 8 hours because you're going to break even. You know,
yeah.
Think about what you're doing. Don't overeat. Eat your normal amount. And just doing math alone, you will lose some weight.
And it's not for everyone, and there could be some side effects, right?
Absolutely. You know, this is not a diet for diabetics. you know, you don't want to stress the system like that. And then certainly individuals who are pregnant, you don't want to stress the fetus. So you want to make sure that you've talked to your physician to make sure this makes sense and to say, okay, if I'm going to do this, what types of food should I eat while I am eating? And really, it's a chance to get your lifestyle back into change. And again, also start to talk about, hey, you know what, if you exercised while you were doing this, you know, the impact of it is going to be quite good.
You hear a lot about weight loss pills, and now there's news about a drug that mimics exercise. Really?
Yeah. How about that? You know, oh, I don't want to exercise. Well, I'm just going to take this pill instead. It's interesting. Now, this hasn't been tested in humans yet. It's only been tested in mice, but it is a drug that they are looking at to see, is this a drug that we could use for obesity and heart disease? And now, if it pans out, it's going to be amazing.
Yeah, well, that's,
it's still very early on.
I'll put that in the too good to be true department for now. This obesity study that was done recently, and man, this is interesting, a new theory about the key driver of obesity, fructose. How about that?
Yeah, so it is pretty interesting, and people have to understand, we have fructose, we see a lot of fructose. We see it in the fruit that we eat as small amounts, but probably more importantly, everyone has heard about these high fructose corn syrups. And it's interesting because fructose is important for animals. And what do I mean by that? What it does is it prepares animals for migration, hibernation, for the winter, because what fructose does is it drives us to eat more food that is then stored as fat. So it triggers cravings from fatty foods and carbohydrates, and it blocks the body from using the stored energy sources. So it is telling animals, us included, hey, don't use your stored energy, and as a matter of fact, I'm going to make you crave to have bring in more so that you take in some so that you have enough energy for when we won't have that, which is great for animals, right? The fruit and the in the winter, I'm sorry, we still have grocery stores, so we don't need those things.
Yeah.
So really important that we really monitor how much fructose we're taking in, because like you said, it is a huge trigger for cravings for fatty foods and carbohydrates.
Yeah, just eat the real fruit. I take my glasses to the grocery store when I shop now so I can read those ingredients. Dr. Kevin Most, Northwestern Medicine, thank you, sir. We'll talk next Monday.
You got it, Bob. Take care. We'll talk soon.